I'm Daniel Centeno. You're listening to CJRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative. The Ontario Ministry of Indigenous Affairs is hosting a virtual series in honor of Treaties Recognition Week. Dr. Cynthia Wesley-Esma spoke to a digital audience about Canada's history of treaties with its Indigenous communities and practical steps that can be taken to address reconciliation and update terms for modern application. Dr. Wesley-Esma is the Chair on Truth and Reconciliation at Lakehead University. She's an honorary witness and chair of the governing circle for the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation at the University of Manitoba. Further, she's a member and resident of the Chippewa of Georgina Island First Nations in Ontario.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about how long we've been having this particular conversation. The Treaties Recognition Week has not been around that long, maybe about 5 years. And I think it's really been in the last 20 years that we've been having some very important conversations about treaties in Ontario and Canada. And of course, the calls to action from 2015. So there's a lot going on, the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. There's just a whole lot going on that makes this a very exciting time for Indigenous peoples and obviously for the rest of Canada. So why don't we go ahead? All right, so I want to start with something that's that's an icon for Indigenous peoples, and it's about actually reminding people in Canada that the protocols around treaty making did not arrive with Europeans. They were actually in place long before and were very much a part of the relationships that Indigenous peoples had with each other. So this one was between the Ojibwe and the people that are now the Six Nations. And it's called The Dish with One Spoon. And it is made of wampum. And it is about having a relationship or an agreement between each other that we would share the lands and the resources, that we would work together. There would be one dish which would constitute, you know, the land or the continent or really basically the world, I guess, at the time. And there would be one spoon because we all need to eat together and be a part of that. But the other thing that was really important about this conversation was that we would maintain our sovereignty, that we would not be giving that up to each other, that we would maintain that. And I think that that's a really integral part of the conversation that we're having today with Canada on this nation-to-nation basis that says, we recognize that you're here. You need to recognize that we fully understand the idea of relationship and protocol and ceremony, and we want to continue that conversation. So I think it's important to actually do a little bit of defining, because I've done a lot of these conversations and it surprises me how many people don't really know what a treaty is. They're like, well, what is a treaty? Well, it's a formal legally binding written agreement between people in international law. They are recognized, and of course, many of the treaties that have happened in Canada have been taken into the international courts to actually define or at least to discuss because they were not fulfilled. But there are also agreements made between the government of Canada and Indigenous peoples and sometimes provinces and territories. And sometimes, mostly the commissioners were supposed to be federal, but sometimes they were provincial and they were anointed by the federal government as commissioners and given the power to go out and define these treaties and sign them. Now, again, lots of people went out and did this work. We don't have time here to talk about all the many people that were sent out to do this. But the realities were they set out these agreements, and many of which were not fulfilled. And this is the reason why we now have what we call land claims. And land claims fall out of the treaty process, and they're seeking to resolve the wrongs. They're seeking to either create resources back, to provide lands that the communities can work with, or sometimes it's a monetary compensation, and I'll talk a little bit about that as we go forward. But there are comprehensive claims, and those comprehensive claims deal with rights and mostly lands, and specific claims deal with specific issues. So one example I know from the Anishinaabeg Nations in Ontario, Southern Central Ontario, was the provision that was included in the treaty of giving the chiefs suits. And they never got them. And so when you took that specific claim and you gave it modern context, It actually resulted to a little under $1 million of resource that was returned to the communities because she's never got those suits. We're actually calling it the Armani claim at one point because it was about these suits. But it did get resolved, and those are very specific things. And so there's different kinds, and there are also claims of a different nature. So there's a lot around land claims that people don't necessarily know about because many of these conversations were not in the public domain. And many of them are still not in the public domain because they're generally conversations that happen between a nation and Canada. So they're nation-to-nation agreements and negotiations. And quite often they result in a significant amount of money as opposed to something else because many of the lands in southern central Ontario, anywhere where we are with the Williams Treaty, for instance, are already occupied. So it's a willing buyer, willing seller situation. So there's lots about this that we can't get into, but it's a very important part of the conversation between Canada and First Nations across the country.
One recent example she mentions is the ongoing Mi'kmaq lobster fisheries dispute in Nova Scotia. The dispute is rooted in a 1999 Supreme Court ruling that gives Indigenous fishers the right to fish during off-seasons. The ruling is part of the Halifax Treaties, which date back to 1760.
So where in Canada? So again, here's some of the conversations that happened across the country, and there are 70 recognized, but there are literally hundreds of treaties across the country, smaller ones. And I included this because there's the population in 2006, 619,000 Indigenous peoples of the treaty First Nations. Now, there are also non-treaty First Nations that never signed a treaty in these other places. But the population itself as of 2016 was almost 2 million Indigenous peoples in Canada, making up almost 5% of the population. So it's a small population, but it has a very loud voice because of these treaties. If these treaties had not been signed, we would not probably be having the conversations we are having right now, but we are, and they do need to be honored. So you can see from across the country, in of importance are things like the Maritime Peace and Friendship Treaties, which was more recently in the news because of the lobster fishery. And the question around what happened there. And the treaty there was not like the number treaty. It was more a statement that said that the Indigenous peoples have the right to commerce. And that was defined by the courts as a treaty that said, yes, they have a right to engage themselves in commercial fishery. But then there was no number put on that. It was they were able to earn a moderate income, but there was nothing that said it could be this much or that much. So those are still very much in negotiations and are continuing to happen. And the Robinson Treaties that were signed in the 1850s forward, there's a conversation going on there right now to update the treaty payment, which was $5 per person. And they want to quantify that in modern terms and bring that up. So that is now in the courts and it has not been resolved. So there's a number of different, the Williams Treaty has been resolved. It was resolved in 2018. I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go forward. Again, a very important conversation. And as you can see from this map, a very big part of the territory. And so one of the things that's also very true of these agreements as they're being made today is that they're very specific. They're very unique to each of the nations that is signing them. There's not one model for everybody. They don't all look the same. In fact, they look exceptionally different because of where they're actually situated. So on the West Coast, the fisheries, the salmon, the whaling, like all very different from perhaps what's happening in James Bay with the lands there or Nunavut. So lots of diversity across the country. And really important for you to understand and know something about because these are the things that are happening with your government and the nations across Canada that are going to ultimately have some impact on you. They're not going to be taking lands away from you because that's not how it works. We always have said, third party interests are paramount. Nobody's going to move you from your territories as these agreements come to full fruition. But they will have some impact because of other things like the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which has been given royal assent, and the free prior informed consent that comes out of that. And prior to that, the duty to consult and accommodate, which was a part of the conversation around understanding that Indigenous peoples, based on those agreements, had a right to come to the tables and be a part of the negotiations process and the development conversations that were going on across Canada to help maintain our economy and and build a future. Very important you understand that those things are happening as we speak. And it's not about a negative impact on Canada. In fact, every time a land claim is resolved in Canada, in Ontario, in each of the provinces, it has a tremendous impact on everybody that is in a region. So when we settled the Williams Treaty in 2018, we don't have a Bank of Georgina Island. The money that comes out of those settlement goes into trust. It goes into the banks that are contiguous to our First Nation communities everywhere across Canada. We buy our cars, we buy our supplies, we stay in hotels, we have meetings, we buy groceries. And everybody in the region actually benefits from the resolution of some of the historic grievances that have been a part of this larger conversation across Canada. They are a component of Canada's nation building because they create strong Indigenous communities that actually contribute to the rest of Canada, have been contributing actually. I mean, the whole treaty process was about contributions of lands and settlement territories for a lot of people that we had no idea even existed. But those things happened, and everybody benefits from these conversations. They establish certainty with respect to the ownership management of lands and resources, that stable climate for investments. So now there's a conversation. It's not Indigenous peoples necessarily, because it's still happening, because it doesn't mean everybody agrees, but that they're coming to the table and they're talking about what kind of developments are going to happen and how the First Nations communities, Métis, Inuit communities can actually also be a part of that conversation and benefit and lift their own communities, lift their own health, and lift their own economic potential. So very important part of that conversation.
She elaborates on the colonization backdrop of treaties and relations with the Indigenous communities, and how reconciliation is still an ongoing process. This process includes the current residential schools investigation across Canada. Resolutions and settlements continue to be negotiated between the government and Indigenous communities, its survivors, and the multiple generations that follow.
So, again, those perspectives. Pretty important when we have these conversations. And again, I want to step back a little bit again to talk about this. So this is Ontario. These are all of the First Nation communities across Ontario, and they are living everywhere in the province. And there are a significant amount of people, like over 300,000 people that are living in Ontario. But the point of it all is it started with a colonization process. And it has had a tremendous effect. So in spite of all of those agreements, in spite of all those treaties, things did not go well. And we are in this place where we're now working very hard on actually correcting. So it's not only a correction of the resolution of the return of lands or the compensation for those lands, it's now a resolution process for the colonization process, which put people in these places where the residential schools were put up, and the physical and sexual abuse that occurred out of those, the loss of language and culture, which we're now having a conversation that we have a commissioner of language restoration, the surrender and disease and death, self-hatred, loneliness, all of the things that came out of the residential school. And we're still dealing with all of this maltreatment and trying to bring it back to Minapamatsuan, which means basically we're trying to bring it back to a good life. So while all of this other conversation is going on around the resolution of historic grievances through land claims and through the treaty process, we're also deeply engaged in another conversation that is about the resolution process and the rebuilding or the lifting of Indigenous people's well-being from having gone through these experiences. So go ahead and we'll talk a little bit about the residential school process that was the beginning or the genesis of these issues. So this is a map of the residential schools across Canada. And you can see that in spite of the fact that underneath all of this, there were treaty agreements that were made that were supposed to take care of the well-being of First Nations peoples or Indigenous peoples across Canada, that on top of that has been a tremendous, harm, tragedy because of these residential schools. And you'll notice in the prairie provinces of Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Alberta, where they have the seemingly significant issues around child welfare and continuing discrimination and problems, that you have a huge number of residential schools. And so you need to understand that when you look back at that, you have to understand that if seven generations went through these residential schools, none of whom received treatment for the trauma that they received there, that has been carried forward into present day. We are now in a process where we're trying to negotiate these settlements. We're negotiating and working on the whole question of resolution of governance systems, and we're also working on the resolution of physical and emotional and spiritual traumas and mental health. So again, lots of reasons why we want Canada to, and the people of Canada, to understand the history and also understand why it's important that we have these conversations at all. So that's what it looks like. And of course, you also know that out of this has become the question of the unmarked graves. And at all of these schools, if almost 50% of the children that went to these schools died, either in these schools, outside of these schools, or when they got home of tuberculosis and other things, then you understand again that, you know, there's layers of conversation that are a part of this. It's not just, oh, there's these treaties and isn't that interesting? It's like all of those things started the process of undoing of Indigenous peoples over a course of time because of the desire to have their lands and resources in the hands of government, in the hands of settlers, in the hands of other peoples. And so now we're in this process of trying to bring that conversation back to resolution and to restore. A lot of that is about myths, and the myths that have been generated out of those conversations about who pays taxes and who doesn't, you know, who actually is an alcoholic and who's not. There's a lot of mythology that's been built around the conversations, much of it to protect, I think, the interests of those who have actually done much of the damage. And then there's the facts. And so this conversation with you is about trying to ensure that you have an access to the facts and you have an understanding of all of the things that have happened over the course of time that has led us to this conversation where we wonder, you know, because that's what put me on a pathway to education and to really trying to understand the history, was the fact that I didn't know what happened and I needed to know so that I could better understand my parents, because both of them spent 20 years between them in residential schools and I grew up with that impact. And I didn't want myself to live that impact, and I didn't want my children to live that impact. So I had to understand, and I know a lot of you feel the same way.
Ontario Minister of Indigenous Affairs, Greg Ridford, issued a statement for Treaties and Recognition Week. Quote, "This week, Ontario is marking the 6th annual Treaties Recognition Week by encouraging students and the public to learn about treaties from diverse Indigenous perspectives and supporting greater understanding of the importance of treaties in Ontario." End quote. I'm Daniel Centeno. You're listening to CJRU 1280 AM. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative.